On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we dive deep and pick apart Roki Sasaki's first spring training outing. What did we like? What are we concerned about? What does this make us think about his prospects for this year and beyond? We'll have a conversation with good friend Mike Rooney about the college baseball season 2025. College season has been underway for about a month. We're going to try and get you interested in it. And we'll see how that goes. Also, who's still a free agent and why? Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that might sweat more than Roki Sasaki. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I know it can get hot in Arizona, but that boy was schwitzy last night.
A sweaty fella. Is that why his hat kept sliding off?
Yes.
I don't think it was too windy at Camelback Ranch on Tuesday evening, as this episode of Baseball Barbacast will be discussing Roki Sasaki's Cactus League debut. Later on in this episode, you're going to hear a conversation with our good friend Mike Rooney of D1Baseball.com, kind of talking about some of the early results and early takeaways from the Division I college baseball season. But we also, with this Roki start on the calendar, relief appearance, I should say, not a start on the calendar, we wanted to make sure we talked about that. So the bulk of the show, you're going to hear our conversation with Rooney. We're going to talk about some of the free agents that are still out there as March rolls on. We're going to talk about that later. Most of this episode was recorded earlier on Tuesday evening, but of course we wanted to wait for Roki to throw so that we could wake up here on Wednesday and talk about it. So that is, Jake, of course, our opener.
The long-awaited exhibition debut of Roki Sasaki, the Japanese flame-throwing phenom, the envy of all 29 major league teams. The Rockies probably weren't interested. Signs with the Dodgers. How good is he? How good can he be? Our first real glimpse happened on Tuesday evening as Roki came in out of the bullpen in the fifth inning for a three-inning stint against the Cincinnati Reds. Well, against people paid by the Cincinnati Reds. Some of them will be on the Reds. Some of them won't be.
It was a pretty decent lineup. He did face, I know the bottom part of the order was maybe not guys we're going to be seeing get a ton of plate appearances this year, but we saw him face, you know, some of the guys that'll be the main. We saw him face Ellie. We saw him face, you know, Matt McClain.
So he throws three innings, two hits, one walk, five strikeouts. Pretty good. There's so many different directions we could go. I want to start with just the visceral experience of seeing this.
Yes.
Even though we were on television and not in person, our colleague Russ Dorsey was there. Just seeing the way that this guy moves down the mound is bonkers.
Well, and I think the television experience is actually important. Right. Yeah. Because, you know, I was lucky enough to be there for his first live BP when I was down in Arizona. And so I kind of got to see him move up close and watch the delivery with my own two eyes, even in a controlled backfield setting. But obviously, most of our Roki experience this year is going to be on television. Seeing him in Major League Ballpark, seeing him in high definition MLB TV quality, right? Like this is what it's going to look like. And so starting to learn and get familiar with how he moves and how his pitches move on a screen is very valuable. And I think when you talk about like all the hype and everything is so much about how good is this guy going to be? And that's all true. But I think what's so fun and so interesting about Roki, honestly, even more so than Yamamoto in that we did a year ago, although I remember having a similar feeling, is not about how good he is. It's just like, what does this look like? What is this pitcher? How does this pitcher operate? It's obviously the results were pretty good last night, and we could talk about that. But it's just starting to understand what kind of pitches he's going to offer. And for him in particular, that is very relevant because his best pitch is not really something we have really seen.
So first off, he looks like a turbocharged marionette falling down the mound. There are limbs going everywhere. And then, boom, the ball comes jetting out of his hand at 98 miles an hour. And I think we should start there with the fastball, because that is the most important pitch for most pitchers. It will be the most important pitch for Roky Sasaki. He threw it 54% of the time last night, 25 of them, and it averaged 98 miles an hour. A big storyline around Roky Sasaki over the winter was that his 2024 season in NPB, his velocity had dipped a bit, closer to the 94, 95, 96 range. And one of the questions that he had for major league teams when he was doing these visits was, why did my velocity dip? Because I want to have it back. And early days, obviously, it is March 4th, it was last night, but the velocity looked more back to where it was 2 years ago when he was in the WBC than where it was last year. And I think that is relevant because the shape of the fastball is not elite on its own necessarily, but when you're throwing it at 98, it is elite. This is going to go without saying this. You all know this. You're all smart people. The difference between 98 and 96 is a lot more than 2 miles an hour, right? Like, that is a big, big deal in terms of how much he can lean on that pitch. Because as we saw last night, hitters, even not great big league hitters like Austin Wins, can get a barrel to a fastball if they know it's coming and if they're sitting on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was one of Roky's takeaways after. He said, yeah, they'll hit mistakes. And it's true, right? Whether it's LA, whether it's Austin Wins, even if it is 99, if they know it's coming and it's down the middle, like, big leaguers are going to hit it. But I also think that it is true, though, because that margin for error is significant. Now, if the command is not good and you're predictable and you only have two pitches, more on that in a second, that maybe becomes more of a challenge. But if he's at 98-99, it's just so much easier to get away with. This is a minor tangent, but like, there are some pretty amazing stats about some pitchers in particular. Jack Leiter is someone right now who I just wrote about, by the way, but he has some incredible stats about the difference between how his fastball performs at 96 or 97 and above. Like, it's getting, or maybe it's 97, 98. Like, I saw this incredible clip. This was from JJ Cooper, Baseball America, talking about it, how like, it's like a ridiculous difference in how his fastball performs, even if it's just 1 mile per hour difference. And that can be a big deal for someone who is adjusting to the league. And most notably for someone who doesn't have 9 pitches, you know, like Yu Darvish or Seth Lugo or, you know, Bryce Miller, Logan Gilbert, some of these pitchers that have a lot to offer. So let's talk about his other offering, because this is the pitch that caught everybody's attention for all the right reasons. This is the pitch that was most hyped. Now, this is not the first Japanese pitcher to come over and everyone talk about his splitter. Of course, we did this with Kodai Senga with his, you know, ghost fork or whatever you want to call that. Yamamoto's splitter, which we saw in this game, is also quite good. Ohtani has a great splitter. Tanaka, like, this is a pitch that we've seen master. This is obviously a pitch that is much more common in for pitchers that are developing in Japan. However, Sasaki's is different. And because we have the data, we know just how different it is. Now, you don't actually need the data to know, because if you watch it, you're already like, hold on a second. What was that? Because most splitters, and I think Yamamoto was a good example. Yamamoto's splitter was cooking earlier in this game. But at the same time, it always looks pretty much the same. You know what it's going to look like. It's going to look like a fastball, and it's about 90 miles an hour, and it is just going to absolutely dive. And it is nasty, and it is really good, but you know what it is going to look like. Now, hitters are still missing it because it's so good. But when you're watching as a viewer, it's like, okay, that's the splitter, right? With Sasaki, it was a little bit harder to do that.
And the reason for that is the horizontal movement on the pitch. Most splitters are going to have a little bit of run or tail or fade are the three words that you'll hear people use. What that means is the pitch, besides just diving down vertically and falling off a table, it's going to move towards the arm side. And what that means is right-handed pitcher is going to, the ball is going to move a little bit towards the right-handed batter as the ball goes down. Sasaki's splitter sometimes does that, but sometimes it goes the other way. It cuts. It moves away towards the glove side, away from a right-handed hitter. Not a ton like a slider, but a non-insignificant amount that it was difficult at times to determine whether he was throwing a slider or a splitter. now, if you have Baseball Savant up, the way you can determine this is the spin rate of a ball, right? A slider, you're going to rip it off like a Beyblade, whereas a splitter, you're going to stick that thing in between your middle finger and your pointer finger, and you're going to kind of let it like poof, like plop. I don't know what the word is, like clunk out of your hand. You're not like ripping it. It's almost like,
yeah.
It's kind of almost dropping out of your hand as you're pushing it forward. And that's going to mean that's going to kill a lot of spin on the ball. For Sasaki, like this pitch is bananas. Like it's bonkers. It's as good as a pitch like this as we've really ever seen. And it is a magic offering that is going to help him a great, 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 great deal.
Here's the most important thing though about the splitter. When we get back to the data you mentioned, okay, Savant tells me, oh, that one that moved, you know, glove side had, you know, 1700, 1800 RPM. That must have been a slider. Splitters in general, yes, for the most part, you are killing spin, right? Sasaki's splitter last night averaged just over 500 RPMs, okay? That would be the lowest spin rate on average for any splitter in baseball. So what you have now is a pitch that is almost functionally acting closer to a knuckleball. Now, obviously, that's much higher than a knuckleball, but it's closer to that, and that's where I think the unpredictability comes with it. Maybe, I don't know. I think we are going to learn the degree to which Sasaki is purposefully,
yeah,
you know, sending it right, sending it left, or if it's just he has a good enough command that he doesn't really care which direction it goes because the movement is so good and that he can control just enough that even if it's going slightly right or slightly left, it doesn't matter to him as long as he's throwing it generally in the direction that he wants. This is what we're going to learn about him. We're in the very early stages of having this be there. But the fact that it has no spin, that is what makes it objectively unique, not to mention why it is moving, or that is part of why it is moving in all these unpredictable ways, but also just what it looks like and how hitters are clearly confused at what they are seeing, on top of the fact that the reason it works is because they think it's a fastball, right? The arm speed is still there. It's not as hard as Yamamoto's. That's also an important note, right? We have seen splitters up closer to 90, 91, 92. It's not that hard. It's more in the 84, 85. But it's just, I mean, that's what makes it different. It has truly the least spin we've seen on a splitter, certainly from a starter. And this is where I want to open this up to just like, he's unique in general. And this being him, maybe being a two-pitch pitcher for a lot of this rookie season is also really interesting.
You could just watch the catcher. Hunter Fiducia, who, you know, has been in the major leagues and has caught like every good Dodgers pitcher in spring training. Mm-hmm. It looks as if I was back there.
It looks like he's catching a knuckleball.
It looks like he's catching a knuckleball.
Yeah.
And you rarely see that with a non-knuckleball. Just it looks like he got crossed up a couple different times.
Yeah.
Like not knowing where to put. It was fascinating to watch that dynamic of it. Now that's the positive. Mm-hmm. I want to touch a little bit on the negative. He is not a finished product right now. And that came across with the sliders that he was throwing. He threw three of them. They were all in the 83-mile-an-hour range. And they weren't really that good. The problem, I'm putting this in quotes because I'd rather have Roki Sasaki than any other prospect in baseball. The problem is that there's no pitch in the velo range, right? That's like from 98 down to the splitter, which was what, around like 86?
Yeah, splitter averaged 86, slider averaged 83, fastball averaged 98. Yep.
I would rather have him just rip the crap out of the slider of more of like a bullet slider that he throws at 90, 88, in that higher band. Like, I just think that's going to be a more effective pitch. But remember,
above the splitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he needs something in between there. But look, he's 23. He's not a finished product. We saw Yamamoto add pitches during the season last year. Mm-hmm. What he is now is not what he's going to be in May, is not what he's going to be in July, is not what he's going to be in 2 years. And I think what we saw last night is he can get outs in the big leagues right now. Just because of how amazing the splitter is and how hard he's throwing, I'm a little bit skeptical about like throwing him out there in the first week of the year and expecting him to throw six innings.
Yeah. And obviously there's questions about the workload and durability that are separate, but part of this conversation, but if we just focus on the repertoire and we focus on how he is going to get out, I think it's a totally fair question. The other thing too is, you know, Yamamoto, a lot of fastballs, a lot of splitters. He had the curveball, and he obviously was working in the cutter. We started to see more pitches, more depth there. So then you think about it. All right, let's say the slider is not ready. Now, it is worth mentioning that last year in Japan, his split was 46% fastball, 25% slider, 28% splitter. Now, the year before, it was 35% splitter, 50% fastball, 14% slider. So last year, he tried to work on the slider. So in this small sample, obviously, it was really just those first two pitches.
I would just say quickly, I think part of that is because the fastball velo was down, and so there was a little bit less of a differentiation there.
Sure.
But keep going.
That's possible. Now, I know there's also reporting that he, after the WBC, like, really wanted to work on that third pitch, working on that, learning it from Yu Darvish, and trying to realizing that just having two pitches, if he was thinking about this jump to MLB, is going to be tough. Okay, so then you think, all right, are there pitchers right now that are succeeding as starters throwing just fastballs and splitters? There's one very prominent example, and it's Kevin Gausman. But other than that, it's hard to find starters who are throwing, let's say, 80%+ combination of fastballs and splitters as starters.
Fastball splitter, yeah. Fastball slider.
Oh,
Spencer, two pitches is a much longer list.
Two pitches we've seen. And that's why, but this is what I'm saying. We're talking about what makes him unique. We've seen Gausman essentially do that. And part of that is because he has one of the best splitters that we've seen from any, you know, American born pitchers, certainly as starters. Now, Gausman, we've seen him mix in more sliders, more breaking stuff. Of course, over the course of his career, we've seen more pitches from him. But he has held up as a very good starting pitcher over a full season, throwing mostly fastballs and splitters. So it's doable. But so we could see that from Sasaki, at least in the early going. I'm sure they're going to want him to try and find that second pitch or that third pitch. And it is really interesting. You mentioned that velocity band because you're right. Right now, the slider, he's throwing it slower than the splitter. And so is it going to make more sense for him to have that be a harder pitch, something closer to a cutter?
Yeah.
We're going to find out. Again, the dude's 23. There's so much more learning for him to do. And the Dodgers are a great place for him to figure that out. But this is an intriguing first look because you can see, like, he probably can get a lot of outs just throwing these two pitches. But he also is probably going to allow some... Well, I know he didn't allow any home runs last night. He allowed a couple nearly foul home runs to Austin Wins and Carlos Jorge, which is a good example of, like, if he leaves the fastball to the wrong person, that thing's going to go a long way. And that's fine. That's fun for everybody. But the splitter is going to be the ultimate equalizer for, I think, a long time in his career, possibly for his whole career, because it's that good.
Last night was a great reminder of why he picked the Dodgers, I think.
Sure.
Because of how unpolished and how much of a not finished product he is. And I would trust the Dodgers as much as any other organization to get me from where I am to where I want to be, mm-hmm. from a pitch design, pitch development standpoint. They did it in the middle of the season last year with a Japanese pitcher coming over with Yamamoto. The proof is right there in the pudding. And so I think last night was encouraging for Roki Sasaki's career and, like, what I think he's going to be. But I do not expect him to win the Rookie of the Year. I do not expect him to be in the All-Star game. Yeah. I expect him to not work that deep into games until he develops that third pitch. Mm-hmm. But wow.
Yeah.
What a freaking arm talent this is.
Yep.
The one thing, though, that he really needs to figure out is to keep that freaking hat on his head. He's got a real mop up there. Like, he's got some thick
black hair. Yeah.
He's got good hair. We need to, like, this is not a sustainable solution. I had a college teammate named Matthew Ashbaugh who had so much head whack that when he pitched, his hat fell off on every single pitch. Yeah. So he used to basically wear this, like, pseudo do-rag underneath his hat that was then clipped onto his hat.
Nice.
So I think we might need to figure something out there with Sasaki. Dodgers pitching dev people, give me a call. I got ideas.
All right. That's good. Definitely top priority. Keeping that hat on his head. Anything else on this before I set up our conversation with Mike Rooney?
No, here's
my last thing. I said I already hinted at it. Yamamoto is also pretty freaking good, man. I was like, oh boy. Like, this guy is, like, in the perfect spot now where he gets to be this $300 million pitcher that nobody's paying that much attention to. He's so great.
Cy Young pick. There you go.
That is fun. That's the other thing about Sasaki from a physicality standpoint is like he's clearly very skinny. Like you keep looking at him and I remember in person too, I had the same feeling of being like, wow, he's a lot bigger than I thought. But also like, no, he's like still clearly way smaller than Ohtani, who's enormous, right? Whereas Yamamoto was a small dude. And so It's a funny kind of mix or like a blend between the two where he's like tall and gangly and like he's, you know, he has big shoulders, but he still does not look filled out at all. He still looks like a young kid.
Him facing Ellie was the lankiest batter pitcher matchup of all time.
Yes, well said. All right. Before we get to our conversation with Mike Rooney, allow me to mention the fact that fantasy baseball season is here. As you know, we had our Yahoo Fantasy Baseball League last year. Will we bring it back this year? We'll see. Maybe some more details on that at some point leading up to opening day. But for now, let me tell you, it is indeed time to start that long journey towards the coveted 2025 Fantasy Baseball Trophy. Create or join a league with your crew. Start preparing for your draft. If you do not have a league to play in, join one of our Yahoo Public Leagues. Start drafting instantly today. Sign up in the Yahoo Fantasy app or head to yahoo.com/fantasy baseball. Jake Mintz, you are about to hear our conversation with Mike Rooney. You actually participated in our conversation with Mike Rooney.
I did. I was there.
We love college baseball and we wanted to talk about it on this episode of Baseball Barbercast, and Mike Rooney was the perfect person to do that. He is someone that we have been lucky enough to get to know over the last few years, and his passion for college baseball is infectious, and we love it so much. So this conversation was earlier on Tuesday evening before there was some interesting stuff happening with some of the teams we talked about last night when we talked to him. So we're not going to acknowledge any of the midweek action, but hopefully this is a nice little introduction into the 2025 college baseball season. So enjoy this conversation with Mike Rooney, and we'll be right back here on Baseball Barbercast. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. It is now an absolute privilege to be joined by one of our best friends in the entire baseball universe. He played college baseball with Craig Counsell, and now he is the GM, CEO, president, manager, skipper of the fabulous Rune Dogs. It is Mike Rooney of D1Baseball.com and other assorted college baseball enterprises. Mr. Rooney, thank you so much for joining us.
Gentlemen, this is Mike from Newtown Square. First time, long time. What do I do now that I've never been a first time, long time caller to the
you
program?
You answer questions. Usually you host your podcast on D1 Baseball when you're on it. That's not how this is going to go. We're in charge. We're going to ask you questions and then you're going to answer them. Those of you who listen to this podcast know that Jordan and I often reference college baseball. The college baseball season is in full swing. We are about a month into it. We know that many of you beautiful listeners are not sickos like us. Maybe college baseball isn't for you. What the next 15 minutes are going to be is giving you the opportunity to open your heart to this world. And we don't think there is a better person on this rotating sphere to do that than Michael Patrick Rooney. Rune Dog, thoughts on my statements?
Yeah, no, the rotating sphere, I'm on my heels a little bit. I'm panicking. I was kind of a C student in science as a kid, so I
Earth
didn't
moves,
know.
Buddy.
Yeah, that's right. But I like it. I appreciate it. What a compliment. I'll take that. Heck yeah.
So, Mike Rooney, you are one of our favorite people because we often talk. It's like, wow, Jake and Jordan, they really like baseball. They can't get enough of it. But you're one of those rare people who are like, I think this guy might like ball more than us, and that is why we felt you were properly equipped to help kind of open up the world of college baseball to a listener that hasn't necessarily spent the last however many years getting into it. And so now that we have, you know, a couple weeks of data, we have some results, we have some teams that look very good, some teams that don't look as good as we thought, some players that have certainly caught our attention. We wanted to kind of give that big picture look at the 2025 college baseball season so far. We're going to focus on the Division I level as much as I want to talk D3 and let you kind of talk about some of the things that have caught your attention. So Jake, where would you like to begin?
I want to ask Runes 5 questions, and the first one is painfully simple. Who good?
So, you know, we have to start, everything in college baseball starts with the Patriot League. I'm just kidding. It's, as much as that will be part two of the pod where there's no hot mics. So
who's
this is a
the
great
best
question.
Team? Who's yes. the best team?
This reminds me of my brother getting me into the English Premier League. You know, like, how do you get someone into this thing? So here's everything in college baseball, as you guys know, starts with the SEC. We have a really cool deal in the SEC right now. Tony Vitello, if you only remember one name from the next 15 minutes as a casual baseball fan, Tony Vitello is where you need to do your research. This is like the WWE meets college baseball. It reminds me of, I grew up with the Big East basketball, and John Thompson and Jim Boeheim hated each other, but they were the two best programs. And Tennessee, so I'm going to start with this statement. Tony Vitello is a sorcerer, because in college baseball, we have this thing where you win the national title and then you are just a disaster for the next 1 to 2 years. And Tony Vitello, so, you know, Mississippi State won the national title in 21 and then vanished for 2 years. Ole Miss 22 and then, you know, can't make the conference tournament two years. LSU squeaked into a regional last year. Tony Vitello won the national title with Tennessee last year and put the curse on A&M. So A&M finished second and then still had to wear the curse because they were the preseason number one and they've been a hot mess. So the SEC is, the fan bases are crazy, and this is where the best players are playing right now.
I'm so glad you started with Tennessee, because while Texas A&M coming into the season looked like, because of the guys they had coming back, a lot of familiar faces, a lot of people expected them to be the number one team, Tennessee, the story of Tennessee is remarkable, and it really does start with Tony Vitello, because while, yes, they do have some history as a program, you know, with guys like Todd Helton, they've had some good players over the years, this was not a relevant program for a long time before Tony Vitello got there. I believe it was in 2017 or 2018, I think, was his first season. Mm-hmm. And the degree to which they have churned out not only, you know, just awesome college players, but also players that have gone on to become already big leaguers, guys like Garrett Crochet, is astounding. What's so impressive about this team now and the team that won the national championship last year is, a couple years ago when you mentioned that WWE style, all the antics kind of off the field that made them very unlikable, they have kind of translated that, and some of that is still around, but it's become a juggernaut that you cannot deny. It is no longer about what is all that comes with it. It is the fact that they are kicking your ass on the field with new players every season. That is what is so compelling about Tennessee, particularly right now.
Yeah, their talent acquisition machine is outrageous. So they play with that swagger, but they never get totally off the rails, because, like, if you're playing at Tennessee, you better play well, or else you'll be keeping a chart, like, later today. Like, it is outrageous how good the talent is. Like, they lost Christian Moore and Blake Burke last year, who are basically, you know, two first-roundish picks, and it's like, they're better. How's that possible?
Well, it's not just that, Runes. They lost five hitters from last season with 20 home runs and 1,000 OPS, gone to pro ball. And they're undefeated and look like the best team in the country. Yeah. That is astonishing.
Those of you who don't follow college baseball intently may remember current Rockies outfielder Jordan Beck, former Tennessee player, rounding first base for a double and flicking off the outfield. Tennessee's energy, that's what it used to be. They have taken that volatile, powerful ball of clay, and they have molded it and redirected it and weaponized it to win baseball games now. Mm-hmm. So they are not just there to jump around and be goofballs. They're actually winning a lot. Runes, who else behind Tennessee is piquing your interest this season?
So LSU is the other great story, because they're the OG of college baseball programs in the SEC. And their coach, Jay Johnson, is equally committed to not having a life and just running a college baseball program like Tony Vitello. Like, they're just, these two deserve each other. It's awesome. They both have incredible teams. Yeah, that's right. It's Jay's wife, Maureen, is amazing. She's like all in. It's just so great. But so LSU's loaded. For D1 baseball, we have LSU number one right now over Tennessee, and there's a little bit of pull mechanics in there. The Tennessee fan base, as you can imagine, handled that well. Yeah. They said we were actually, it was, we were baiting them into subscriptions. That's why we did it, which was great. Mm. that was my good. Favorite sentiment. But LSU's awesome. They had a kid, Jared Jones, who's looks like he could play offensive tackle for LSU. He had 28 home runs last year, somehow doesn't get picked in the draft in a place where he would go out into pro ball. They're loaded. So, you know, like that's the first tier. And then the A&M Texas thing is really fun in college baseball right now, because it's like, can you imagine if after the Yankees were eliminated by the Dodgers in the World Series, the next morning, Aaron Boone announced that he's the new manager of the Boston Red Sox. Like, that's kind of what we had in college baseball, where Jim Schlossnagel goes from A&M losing game three of the finals to now he's the coach at Texas. So A&M's alumni, they didn't particularly care for that. So they just, like, it was a blank check in the offseason for A&M. Like, NIL was like, you know, second mortgage on your house, we need a shortstop. Let's go. So that's a really fun storyline we've got going too.
So that's a good transition. NIL has transformed college sports over the last handful of years. And it is, the numbers in college football in particular are mind-numbing and make the math work, if this makes sense. Like, the quarterbacks are getting paid enough to buy cars.
Yeah.
Right? Is baseball at that level? How has the NIL market and the transfer portal impacted college baseball at the D1 level since it's become a thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, we're not dealing in baseball with millions of dollars. We're dealing with hundreds of thousands for the elite players. Like, you guys know, Ryan Prager was the ace for A&M last year. The Angels take him in the fourth round, which is probably, I don't know, the Angels probably offered him $700,000. And the, you know, the fan base at A&M said, hold my beer, right? Like, they said, fourth rounders get $700,000, but aces at A&M get more than that, you know, like, and so now that's an exceptional situation. Yes. But like, in the portal, you know, Tommy White, one of the great hitters of this era of college baseball, goes from NC State to LSU, and Paul Skeens goes from Air Force to LSU. Those, you know, those are unique, and they were on the front end. Braden Montgomery goes from Stanford to A&M. I think what's really crazy, and I don't mean to steer us back to Tennessee, but like, Liam Doyle is on the ace of Tennessee's on his third school. He went New Hampshire kid, Coastal, Ole Miss. Now he's at Tennessee, and it's like, you know, his fastball is the best pitch in college baseball. Like, he's found another gear. It's a left-hander up to 99 with a, you know, invisible fastball. And then, you know, it's Gavin Keelan went from Louisville, where he was like an emerging star. Like, they just couldn't quite get him to fifth gear. And now he's got 13 walks already. He had 7 the entire season last year. So the Louisville coaches are probably like, you know, come on, man. Like, what?
Like, don't swing.
Yeah, what are we doing? But it's a thing, you know, like, and the SEC dominates it because they have the most resources.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting. And this has a lot of impacts on all levels of college baseball, because not only do you have a lot of talent from mid-majors, it's hard to, you know, blame these kids who are being offered significant not just opportunities to play on a bigger stage, but obviously financial compensation as well. You want there to still be a level of parity and a level of balance from a competitive standpoint. But the reality is, right now, it's not just the SEC. When you look at the SEC and the ACC, if you look at the D1Baseball.com top 25, yes, you have some mid-majors, you know, mixed in there. But with conference realignment, which I think we should talk about too, and a lot of that talent being funneled to these two conferences, it's getting pretty extreme, and last year was the ultimate culmination of that, where you had 4 SEC and 4 ACC teams as the 8 teams in Omaha. I know we all want to root for underdogs, and I think we still have great stories in the college baseball postseason, but there is a bit of a risk in the direction that we're going, in that sense that we are going to lose some of those stories, because it's just going to be so much harder for those teams to compete.
I agree and I disagree, and I'm curious what you think about this, Rooney. I think the randomness of baseball inherently makes the sport more top heavy proof than it does for other sports. Because if you, to get to Omaha, to get to the College World Series, you got to win 6 games. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that might sound like a lot, but teams can just get hot, right? In baseball, you can get hot. You can't really get hot in football. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to get hot. And so I think that because our sport is so random, I'm hopeful that we'll keep seeing teams like Oral Roberts make the College World Series like they did 2 years ago. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I'm anxious and curious about it. Like Evansville's another great example from last year where, you know, like Evansville took Tennessee to a game three of a super regional. And, you know, like Tennessee was one game from losing, you know, like for not making it to Omaha, let alone win the national title. Now, Evansville and Oral Roberts gave us the formula, like super old teams, fifth year senior, fourth year senior, sixth year senior, where they're just skilled enough to be really good college players, but they're not sexy enough to be like scooped up by the SEC. I think the one thing that concerns me in our sport is that in Major League Baseball, you guys have the 40-man roster that it feels like to me creates parity. In college baseball, it's kind of like a 70-man, 75-man roster where, you know, like the SEC can just hoard players. But, you know, all that said, I agree with what you said, Jake. It's like, it's, you know, the Super Regional is a three-game series. As we've seen in the Major League playoffs, it's really pressurized. Like, you have a bad day and a half, and, like, welcome to summer ball.
that's it. It can happen really quickly when you get to that super regional round. One of the other things we referenced there is kind of the realignment and just the change of the structure. I mean, the Pac-12, I know this is very personal for you, Rooney, because R.I.P. I know this is something that if you're a fan of other college sports, you've already started to think about, because we saw it in football and it wasn't weird to see Oregon and Ohio State in the same conference. But when you apply it to baseball, you have a very different dynamic that we have now yet to really see unfold, because conference play hasn't quite started yet. And to me, the only comparison I can think of, although I think it's going to be even weirder, is like before Interleague was a weird thing, when you would occasionally see like, oh, whoa, there's like, you know, the Yankees at Dodger Stadium, like would happen once every 10 or so years. But what we're about to see with teams like Stanford going to Boston College, with teams like Oregon going to Michigan State, like we're going to see some very, you know, UCLA at Rutgers, like we're going to see some strange.
The thing about baseball that makes it weirder is that it's four games.
Well,
right.
It's, what do you mean? It's
three games.
It's three games.
Three games.
I would say the weather is the biggest thing about this.
Yeah.
I'd say the weather is the part that
you guys will appreciate this.
Yeah.
I asked Eddie Smith, who's the new coach at Washington, who's awesome. It's a massive rebuild, but he's awesome. I said, how are you selling this whole thing to recruits? And he said, what are you talking about? He's like, my players are going to play in five of the most famous cities in the world this year. We're going to New York City. We're going to Chicago. We're going to Vegas. We're going to LA, and we're going to San Francisco. And I'm like, and you guys know coaches are they're really salespeople disguised as baseball coaches. And I love that. But it is going to be fascinating. Like the SEC is, you know, like if you have SEC fatigue and then they get Oklahoma and Texas, you're like, oh my gosh, like, and you know, but then you've got the Big Ten, which is interesting. Now they have 17 teams, but they do have a former major league executive in Tony Petitti that maybe he can help us get more serious about it. You know, I think the Big 12 probably did the best because they got to add Utah is sneaky good in baseball. They have a $30 million baseball facility being built right now. Arizona and Arizona State have 9 national titles. And then, you know, you guys mentioned Stanford and Cal going to the ACC. That's the one that's like the most gross at face value, except for when you look up and it's Stanford at North Carolina this weekend to open conference play. You're like, yes, yeah.
Yes.
Like,
oh,
sorry about
yeah.
your... Sorry about...
I get to watch Stanford on TV. right, exactly. So
sorry you have to study for your exam on the plane, especially for those kids.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're traveling on Wednesdays, by the way. Like, what's even the point of school at that point? It's like,
they're traveling on Wednesdays and they're getting back late Sunday nights.
And they're playing Tuesdays. They're still probably playing some games on Mondays and Tuesdays. So
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the Stanford thing is very unique. And by the way, Stanford is another team and player that I think we should ask about, because I think one of the most interesting stories in college baseball this year is the arrival of Rentaro Sasaki. We talked about him on this show a few times. This is a one of the most accomplished Japanese high school players that the country has ever produced. Decided to, instead of be the top pick in the NPB draft, he decided to come stateside and start his collegiate career and play at Stanford. He enrolled early a year ago. He was around the team a lot last year. He was not officially on the roster. He played some summer ball, and then he joined the team in the fall officially. And so far, he's doing pretty well. I believe he still has not hit his first collegiate home run. However, he has been hitting in the middle of Stanford's lineup in their first season. I know ACC play hasn't quite started yet, but we'll start to see him playing in a lot more high-profile matchups here in the weeks ahead. But from what you've D1 Baseball had an incredible podcast series that Darren Vaught did on Rentaro's journey, which I can't recommend enough. Everyone should go check that out so you can get more details there. But from your perspective, from what you've seen from him, from what you've heard from people that maybe competed against him so far, what are the early reviews on Rentaro as a D1 baseball player?
Yeah, I think he's different than what I thought he was going to be. I want to probably speak for myself, but I thought he was going to hit for a ton of power. He's a very thick, strong kid, but he's not that tall. Like, I'm not sure if he's 6 foot, but he's a really skilled player. And he's like the Stanford people have talked about, like, he's really got a good feel for winning baseball. Like, it's a left-handed hitter wearing out the left center gap. He's got great feel for hitting with runners in scoring position, you know, all those types of things. I think what we have to slow down on, myself included, is he's really a redshirt freshman in college baseball who is in a country that he'd never been to before, trying to learn a language. Like, I think the player he'll be in May will be quite a bit different than who he's been so far, and he's been plenty good. The other cool thing is Stanford's having a real resurgence, but I think it's just cool hearing the stories about, like, I think he's a really good player who's going to keep getting better, but I think he's also a really famous human, more famous than we get in college baseball, and that part has been really fun. Like, you know, his teammates are, like, hiding him in certain things, and they just, like, the Stanford players who are really bright, you know, kids, they have had, they've told great stories about just being, it's almost like they're talking about, like, we have this rock star who plays baseball. Like, it's like some, it's weird true version of Taylor Swift as their teammate.
It is true.
The thing that's so interesting, right, is, like, we always talk about players from Japan making the transition to MLB and how that's difficult. Hey, you're going to do that, and also you're going to Stanford.
Right.
By the way.
And let's be fair. He came within, like, inches of his first home run opening weekend, and since then he's been kind of a singles hitter, you know, taking his walks and putting the ball in play. For Rentaro, let's open it up. I think our last question is a good place to start to kind of end on, is just, who are some other players that have kind of grabbed your attention so far this season? I mean, obviously you can go to d1baseball.com and pull up the statistical leaderboards and say, oh, look who has a bunch of home runs. Oh, who has got a bunch of strikeouts? You mentioned Liam Doyle at Tennessee on the mound, I think is certainly the answer. But who's one or two players that have really caught your attention so far this season? And then Jake and I can give a couple before we wrap.
Yeah, I think, like, the on the position player side, Jace LaViolette He's a 6'6" center fielder for Texas A&M who has shown plus run times, but he's gotten bigger and he's off to a very slow start, like A&M is. And so he's interesting because coming into the season, he was the guy for 1-1. The shortstop at Alabama, Justin LeBron, is the candidate to go 1-1 in next year's draft. He's only a sophomore. He's got a ton of home runs. And he, like, Justin LeBron, if you're a baseball fan, you're thinking, okay, that's a Division I basketball player that picked baseball accidentally, right? Like, he looks like he could, you know, score 55 points in a basketball game tonight. Like, he's super silky athleticism. He's got 8 home runs already. Incredible defender. So on the position player side, those two kids. On the pitcher side, I give you Jamie Arnold at Florida State is almost like Chris Sale-ish. Like, it's this sidearm lefty that's up to 95. And, like, if you were a left-handed hitter facing Jamie Arnold, you would probably quit baseball that night. Like, you'd be like, I'm good. It's been real. You know, we'll see you at the reunion. And then, you know, I mentioned Liam Doyle for Tennessee. Like, it's crazy. His fastball is, like, he throws his fastball 70% of the time, and college hitters can't do anything about it.
Jake, who's someone that's just stood out to you, and then I'll add a note on Mr. LeBron.
My recommendation for people is to get invested in Stephen Milam. So Stephen Milam, who has, I guess, started calling himself Monster Milam, it is good. His social media handle. is a 5'7"
5'8" allegedly.
Allegedly. I think
he's listed 5'8", but
second baseman for the LSU Tigers.
Shortstop, sir.
Shortstop. Sorry, I forgot he moved over there.
Baseman last year. Yeah.
Who is from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the reason that that is relevant is that he has built himself seemingly in the image of one Mr. Alex Bregman. And it is basically, what if Alex Bregman was even shorter and willing to dye his hair purple with black tiger stripes? That would be Stephen Milan.
Las Cruces, not Albuquerque.
Sorry again, to our New Mexico listeners.
But again, New Mexico's only churning out Division I stars every so often. And the fact that we have another sub-6-foot middle infielder at LSU is very funny.
You watch him, and it's clear that he's, like,
he's been incredible.
Watching Alex Bregman his whole life. It's so cool.
He is really something. I just wanted to say about LeBron at Alabama.
Justin
is really Milam kind of fits for this too. But his ascension is really kind of what makes college baseball so awesome, because it's not that, you know, he's a good prospect in Florida, high school guy, but he's the kind of guy where scouts are like, all right, that's cool. Go to pro ball, get stronger. Let's see how good you really are, you know? And he just showed up last year and it was like, okay, he's good. We get it. this dude is legit. And then he's taken another leap this year. He's not that big, but he's so silky. He's so athletic. He's so explosive. And man, like it's really cool to see that player at Alabama. And damn, I hope they can keep him. Because I have to imagine going into his year next year, we have seen transfers in the SEC. I love Coach Rob Vaughn down there in Tuscaloosa, you know, former Maryland head coach. I like what he's doing there. They're off to a great start. But it's kind of sad that now when players stick around for 3 seasons, we're like, whoa, look at them. they stayed in one place for 3 years, let alone 4. But that is kind of where we're at in college baseball, for better or for worse. But yeah, Justin LeBron is delightful. And there are so many awesome players in college baseball right now, and that's why we love it. And by the way, as we've said, as we continue to laugh at spring training, it's like these games mean a lot to these kids right now, right? I know we're not in conference play yet, but we like stakes. We like seeing players care about the games they're playing in. And so that's why we wanted to take a moment early March here to talk about some college baseball. Mike Rooney, thank you. You did pretty well.
Gentlemen. Yeah, I feel like I met my heroes. Let's go.
I have one last question for you, Rooney.
Yes, yeah. Coach Mintz.
One of my aversions personally that stopped me from getting into college baseball earlier is how large it is and how overwhelming it can seem. You know, you pull up, watch ESPN, and it's like, ah! So how should people shrink their worlds?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's how my brother got me into the Premier League. I think my suggestion is pick a team. And so, like, first pick a league, then pick a team. So, like, if you're someone that would like the Yankees or the Patriots or something like that, then get it, pick one of your SEC teams, right? Like, that's the creme de la creme. If you don't like that, then you know, the other leagues like the ACC or the Big 12 or the Big 10, you know, maybe where you're from could help you pick that, you know, if you have a regional preference or pride in where you grew up. But I think that's the thing to do, is pick a team. And if you wanted me to help you, I would say, you know, like, really strongly consider LSU or Tennessee, because that will get you right in the center of the storm and will actually get you to all the other teams almost accidentally. So that's the key, Coach Mintz. It's a great question. I would do some digging. I'll volunteer my service. I'll help anyone pick a team based on your you know, who you are and what you care about. But that's the answer.
Coach Rooney is happy to help. He's quite active on Twitter, and I'm sure if you asked for recommendations, he would be happy to give you some suggestions. Mike Rooney, thank you so much. We look forward to talking to you again all the time offline. But this was a wonderful Barbacast debut, and we really appreciate it.
Gentlemen, appreciate it. Thank you.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Let's talk about a little bit more professional baseball before we say goodbye. Hello news nugget this week. Hello free agent signing. What is it, January? Jose Quintana signs with the Milwaukee Brewers. Last year, we did a bit on the show where I think it was you literally could not believe that he had never been on the Brewers before.
Yeah.
And here we are.
And they made sure that I didn't have to wonder that any longer, because he will be pitching for Milwaukee in 2025. I mean, this is not a shocking fit. The Brewers are a team that already, you know, they won the division and they made it. It was obviously an awesome season last year, but we were still kind of like, you need some more starting pitching, in a similar sense that we said about Cleveland. So far this offseason, they went out and got Nestor Cortes, which was an interesting way to use the Devin Williams trade chip, in addition to acquiring Caleb Durbin, of course. But now you bring in Jose Quintana, who also threw a ton of innings last year, and you watched him up close with the Mets. Like, he's totally solid. He now joins a rotation that projects to, you know, have Freddy Peralta, Tobias Myers, the breakout rookie last year, Cortes, Aaron Civale, and then hopefully Brandon Woodruff at some point. We don't know exactly when he's going to be ready to roll, but he's coming back from shoulder surgery. So Quintana, it's a good fit. Makes sense. Amazing he's never pitched for the Brewers. I'm sure he will be throwing seven different pitches, you know, 5% of the time this year for Milwaukee, and he'll probably munch another 150 innings. Do they want him to be starting in the postseason? I know it sort of worked for the Mets, sort of didn't, but, you know, the Brewers are going to hope that he helps them get there.
There's a thing that happens in college baseball now where a player on a smaller team will pitch against a good team and do really well, and then the good team will just get that guy in the transfer portal. And it's clearly because the coach just saw the guy throw and dominate against the good team. Jose Quintana faced the Brewers in his last two outings of the year in the regular, first one in the regular season on the Saturday, and then in game three of the wild card round in Milwaukee. So I like to think that the Brewers were like, I should have had that. Now, he got a major league deal. How many are left? The difference between a major league deal and a minor league deal, non-roster invite, it's significant, right? Because if you have a guy in a major league deal, you got him all year, got to pay him all year, unless you trade him. And there are very few of these remaining. Jordan, of the free agents still left out there, who gets a big league contract?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so here are the main guys that, like, realistically could still get a big league contract. David Robertson. He was one of the best relievers in baseball last year. I know he's 40, but, like, I don't understand how nobody has signed him yet. This is super perplexing. Unless he is secretly very injured, this one I do not understand whatsoever. He deserves a major league deal. He was outstanding last year. That is one. Beyond him, Alex Verdugo was a very important part of a team that went to the World Series last year, but we were very skeptical. I mean, I think we thought Verdugo had a chance because he is one of the younger position players that are free agents this year, but he's coming off a truly horrific offensive season to the point where I guess selling I am a good left fielder is not super awesome in free agency right now, no matter how young you are.
I can go and get it in the outfield. Oh, yeah? Where? Yeah.
And I won't strike out. That's kind of his field thing. That's like his whole, like, I won't swing and miss and I can play left. And teams are like, okay.
Sure. That's I can tap dance and make an omelet.
Yeah. It's like, all right. Not enough for us. We will not be giving you millions of dollars. But man, I still would have thought he would have gotten them.
Okay.
I don't know. And here's an injury away.
He had been a league average hitter
for, like, 5 years in a row.
For 5 years. Like, just not great. Not horrible. Just, like, totally fine. A guy you can win with, a guy you'll never win because of. Right. And there's value in that. I didn't get the sense that he was a locker room problem. Like, I know he's a kind of a goober and, like, says a bunch of weird stuff, but he wasn't despised in the Yankees clubhouse by any means. And I am surprised he doesn't have a job. I imagine he is being a little picky about where he ends up and how much it's for. And I do agree with you that Alex Verdugo feels one more injury away from getting a big league deal.
I'm glad you mentioned that, as we had some reporting from, I believe, Joel Sherman, that the Royals tried to sign Adam Duvall for $1 million. And Adam Duvall was like, you're either giving me $3 million or I'm retiring. Now, Adam Duvall is one of the few hitters who was worse than Alex Verdugo last year, as he had a 569 OPS and about 300 at-bats for the Atlanta Braves. Obviously, he's another player who had, you know, a track record of more success before last season, like Verdugo. At the same time, Adam Duvall is 7 years older than Alex Verdugo. And so if Duvall ends up holding strong and retiring, that wouldn't shock me. Whereas Verdugo is not going to retire. I just imagine he's going to want to get on a team at some point.
That's like trying to rob a bank and going, if you don't give me $3 million, I will leave this bank. If you're the teller, you're like, okay.
Right. Door's right there.
Walk. That's like, with all due respect to Adam Duvall, great career, good player. Yeah, no one's paying you $3 million right now. So if that's the case, congrats on the career. He's not getting a big league deal, in my opinion. Jose Iglesias.
Mm-hmm. I mean, another one where it's like, but this is very different, right? Jose Iglesias, one of the biggest stories of the season last year for everything that was happening in his postgame concert. He also hit .337 in nearly 300 plate appearances. So you could say, well, that's ridiculous. He had a .382 BABIP. Yeah, that's true. But he's had ridiculously high BABIPs for basically his whole career. Like, this is kind of his thing. And if you think he can still capably play multiple infield positions, I feel like I'd rather have that than Alex Verdugo. So I'm not sure what's taking that one so long. And let's remember, folks, Jose Iglesias has Scott Boris now. And so there, if, you know, we talked about kind of wrapping up the Scobo, Jose Iglesias, JD Martinez, another Boris client worth mentioning here, still looking for a job.
Kyle Gibson feels like another person who could get Adam Duvall's much desired $3 million.
Well, waiting for the injury, unfortunately, right? I mean, we've already started to see some pitchers go down, unfortunately, but that's part of spring training. And if you're Kyle Gibson, if you're Spencer Turnbull's a little bit weird. He finished the year injured, so I'm not really sure what's happening there. Lance Lynn, another guy, we had some weird reporting about maybe trying to become a reliever. Like, I'm not sure who's desperate to see that, but I guess if he doesn't, is not good at, yeah, sure. I guess if he's, teams do not view him as worth, you know, paying to be a back-end starter anymore, then maybe he tries to latch on in the bullpen. And by the way, you want a guy who's made more starts than literally anybody else over the last 7 years? Patrick Corbin, folks. I know he has been the worst starting pitcher in baseball for multiple years running, but if there's someone you can count on to show up every fifth day and throw the baseball for 80 to 100 pitches, he's probably your guy.
He's also famously way better in a Trump administration.
True, from what we can tell. But, I mean, someone's going to have to give him the chance to prove it. Maybe he becomes a loogie. But he's also someone where it's like, talk about doesn't need the money at this point. I mean, he already got his big contract. So it is weird to think that he might just be done. But also, you know, his stat line says he should probably be done.
If I was a GM, I would give Patrick Corbin $1 million to pitch my bullpen.
I would wait for David Robertson to not be available anymore.
Oh, that's true. other guys. Now, and this is always a bizarre dynamic because this like category of player, they're not riding off into the sunset like David Ortiz or Derek Jeter. There are no gifts given, even though they have accomplished a great deal as major leaguers. Some of these guys just sort of fade away.
Yeah.
1 minute they're there, the next they're not. Anthony Rizzo is a free agent. He said he wants to play. He was not good. Have we witnessed the last Anthony Rizzo plate appearance?
That seems hard to believe. I mean, here's another weird one because, again, it obviously has had some pretty low points in the recent years. But as far as very famous baseball players over the last 10 years, Craig Kimbrell, again, like if we're talking
Hall of Famer,
you have a Hall of Famer. You have to imagine that there is still, okay, yeah, he probably shouldn't be closing anymore, but he could still strike out some dudes in the sixth or seventh inning for an okay team. Maybe he doesn't want to do that, right? Maybe he's in the bucket with the Verlander and Scherzers of the world where it's like, I'm not just going to play. Like, I want to be in a spot that I feel like I can do something greater. But that's another weird one that if he's just kind of done, because to your point, these guys didn't have the opportunity to say like, all right, it's over. Like I'm done. But it's possible the game will tell them as much.
Jose Abreu won an MVP.
Yeah.
Might just be done.
I mean, he's still making a lot of money this year, no matter what.
So. Yeah, he's getting paid either way by the Astros. Miguel Sano, arguably the greatest prospect to come out of the Dominican Republic ever. He might be done. Whit Merrifield, the greatest prospect to ever come out of the University of South Carolina. I'm joking. He might be done. This is always just a very fascinating time of the year to see who's ever going to play again.
And then last but not least, someone sign our friend Brent Honeywell. I would like to see him pitch in the major leagues again. That would make me happy, and it would probably make Brent happy too.
He will throw 50 pitches in an inning if you need him to.
Yeah. Even in the series. He can do it.
How valuable is that?
Nobody else has ever done that. If you get to the very specific situation that the Dodgers were in game 4 of the 2024 World Series, Brent's your guy. But yeah, we're kind of waiting for the true conclusion of free agency here, but that's probably it. And I will also use this time to just mention that, do we have a big March trade in us? Right, we had Cease a year ago. Is there a March trade to come? Again, with so few teams in full-blown sell mode, it's hard to envision what that would be. I don't think the Marlins are trading Sandy before opening day. I don't think the White Sox are trading Luis Robert before opening day. But is there a surprising trade before opening day that we're not thinking of? Hopefully, because trades are fun. But, you know, March does usually have some swaps, and I hope we get to see a few.
It feels like it should be Nolan Arenado, but yet he's still in the Cardinals.
Oh, right. We talk about that trade nonstop for 4 months. I forgot that still hasn't happened. Jake, do you have one anything else before we say goodbye here?
Yeah, I got a little story for you.
All right, let's hear it.
I was at the Pirates today, Pittsburgh Pirates. Went and saw them play baseball. And I ran into a gentleman named Connor Griffin. Who is Connor Griffin? Connor Griffin, who we interviewed at the Combine last year. You can go watch that and listen to it. He was a delightful young child, literally. High school hitter from Mississippi. Pirates took him 9th overall. He is, from a prospect perspective, a very volatile player. Outrageous, stupid athlete.
Yeah.
Can he hit?
Already, yeah.
Time will tell. Connor Griffin saw him in the locker room. The Pirates said, "Hey, man, good to see you. How are you?" He's like, I'm good. You know, I was in big league camp. They sent me down yesterday, but they needed someone to cover for today. So they sent me back over here." And I like pointed at his locker. I'm like, "Was that literally your locker yesterday?" He's like, "Yeah, they made me leave. They sent me to the minor league side yesterday, called me back today." And so he was literally out of his locker, was totally empty. So he had to like bring all of his stuff with him in a bag. And I went down to the game and I was like, this is cool. Like, I'm going to get to see Connor Griffin, like, play on, like, get into a real big league game. And he comes in and he has one at bat and he faces Red Sox spring training invitee Michael Fulmer.
Whoa, Michael Fulmer. Who's what? Okay. How old now? He's got to be 30. Okay, almost 32. Rookie of the year, Michael Fulmer.
And it's Michael Fulmer against Connor Griffin. Connor Griffin is still 18 years old. Okay. Yeah. Michael Fulmer once traded for Yoenis Cespedes.
Oh,
it's been a minute. And Michael Fulmer just goes, breaking ball, breaking ball, breaking ball. Thanks for coming. Like, he takes the first one. It's clear that like he arguably has never seen. I mean, I think he's played in a couple spring training games, but like Michael Fulmer, like that's a big league still. A big league breaking ball. Takes the first two. Third one's in the dirt. Swings through it. That's his only at bat of the day. He plays center field for 4 innings. He does not see a ball. And I just thought this was a hilarious day in the life of a spring training player. Gets sent back to the minor league side, which in Pittsburgh is in a different place. It's like a 10-minute drive from the stadium to Pirate City where they are. So he drives over, plays in the game, barely plays in the game, and then packs it up and goes home. And that's just a day at work for Connor Griffin.
Yeah. I like Michael Fulmer. He's like, this kid was born in 2006. All right, here's some spinny stuff. I don't think he's seen much of this yet. So, yeah, that's great. It is. I'm glad you mentioned that, because about the minor league side and the major league side, this is an interesting spring training dynamic that is totally different in every place. Like, for example, the Mariners, it's just like around the corner. Like, literally, it's just like a different hallway. Like, there's the minor league clubhouse, you know. Pirates, it's like, sorry, pack it up, kid. We got to send you down the road. It's a much more humbling thing, except when you apparently get called back literally the next day.
It's a commute.
It is a commute. Yes.
That's all we got for you. I am still in Florida. I will be, I actually don't know where I'm going to go tomorrow or today, Wednesday, whatever it is. I am going to see Paul Skeens throw live on Thursday, which I am excited about.
That is fun. Well, thank you to our wonderful guest, Mike Rooney, for joining us, talking about college baseball. Thank you to producer Carter Singh for making this show possible. And we will be back on Friday with another episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thanks for listening. See ya.